Welcome back to another edition of the ASEP Equal Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Dr. Jason Woods. Today's discussion is going to be on avoidable imaging again, specifically aiming at renal colic and PE. Our first speaker is going to be Dr. Chris Moore, who's an associate professor of emergency medicine at Yale, an international leader in the use of ultrasound in the emergency department, and is a researcher in imaging in renal colic. After he speaks, Dr. Jeff Klein will be up, and I will introduce him then.
My pleasure to join everybody. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. It's something I've been working on for quite a while, and it's also a privilege to be presenting before Jeff Klein, who was my mentor at Carolina's Medical Center way back. I get the first slot here, but I'm looking forward to seeing his talk as well. So imaging and renal colic, this is the big topic, and we're going to talk about some avoidable imaging, perhaps, as well as a bit about radiation, which is an issue in imaging as well. Quick disclosures, I am funded by HRQ, and I'm widely known as the ultrasound guy. So I do work with some of these companies on trying to advance some of the practice of ultrasound. I should also mention that I'm a consultant on the EQUAL PCPI SAN network. One of my favorite quotes, you can observe a lot by just watching. Yogi Berra, a Yankee, but we'll put that aside. So I want to talk about a case to begin. 37-year-old white male. No past medical history, presents with acute onset of right flank pain and vomiting. Urine is clear, but the dip shows hematuria. He's getting fluids, Toradol, morphine, and Zofran. Got no other history. The nurse might even come out and say, oh, he's got a kidney stone in room 6. This is a guy who's kind of writhing around in the bed. So what happens with this guy? Well, it's actually pretty clear he probably has a kidney stone. So do you even need to image him at all? We'll talk about that. What happens in the usual emergency department in the United States? And I'll tell you, it's pretty much he's going to get a CT scan. We can talk about other things, but I'd be interested to hear if people would approach this differently. So urinary stone disease is currently seen in about 1 in 11 people. It's increasing. It's recurrent. About 50% of people have a recurrent episode in 5 years. You see probably 2 million visits per year in the emergency department that are concerning for flank pain that could be renal colic. Very painful. It's expensive, and about 70% of people diagnosed with urinary stone disease get a CT. We'll talk about imaging rather than diagnosis and management. When did all this CT scan begin? It was actually not far from where I'm sitting right now at Yale University. Dr. Robert Smith published this in 1996, and this was sort of the seminal paper that launched the use of CT scan in place of intravenous pyelography to diagnose renal colic. But I wanted to point out like his key conclusion here. Unenhanced CT is valuable, and it can accurately determine the presence or absence of ureteral stones, but the key part is acute flank pain in whom a clinical diagnosis is uncertain. He didn't say that everybody needs to get a CT scan. He just said, if you're not sure, this is a very good test to determine kidney stone. And I'm not going to argue that it is a very good test. In fact, it's the gold standard. So if this is not an anti-CT talk, but just maybe a bit more thoughtful about imaging. This is in whom a clinical diagnosis is uncertain. So where did this norm that exists in the United States that all first-time renal colic gets a CT? And this is something I hear from residents on a regular basis. Well, it's their first kidney stone. You know it's a kidney stone? Yeah. Are they feeling better? Yeah. Do you think they could go home? Yeah, I'm sure they could, but I haven't done a CT yet. And I traced it back to this guy, Michael Ha, who's ironically, he's a Canadian, and he published this in 2004. And he said, basically, a first episode of clinically suspected nephrolithiasis should undergo CT scanning because it reveals these other diagnoses. We'll come back to those other diagnoses a bit, but this is a slide. It's a bit old now. I'm sure it's flattened out some, but it showed the marked increase in CT scanning in the emergency department, and one of the biggest uses for that has been the CT scan in renal colic. So that was the Smith article in 96, and you can see how CT scans have increased despite more modest increases in ED visits.
And for those of you that are listening and can't see the slide, what we're looking at is a graph that shows that imaging for renal colic has increased significantly more than the total increase in ER visits over the same time. So we're getting relatively more imaging per patient.
So why do we always get these CT scans? Well, one thing, people are worried about bad things, and the big bad triple A, abdominal aortic aneurysm, which certainly can present as flank pain or back pain, but it's also amenable to ultrasound imaging. So this is the table from the Ha article that talks about the impact of CT scan. And if you look at this list, it is largely incidental findings, enlarged prostate, right renal cyst, possible ulcerative colitis, right adrenal adenoma, lots of things that actually, as an emergency physician, I'd rather not have to know about. They're probably not related to the pain, and they provide something that I need to follow up on, and that's an incidental finding, which we'll also talk about briefly. We looked at this, again, bad things. In other words, acute alternative diagnoses that are discovered on CT when you do a CT for somebody you suspect renal colic in. And one of the things that can help you discern patients that either they have high low or they need a CT for obstructive stone is the presence of pyuria or evidence of infection. If you exclude those patients, though, you'll find that under 3% of people really have something that could be considered bad or actionable. And even among those, some of the things are likely self-limited. So it's a pretty small number of patients. And the converse of this is CT helping us to expedite care, to make your admission decision, to decide who you're going to intervene on and when. And there's a couple articles on this that came out after this rate increase in CT use. And basically, they both came up with the conclusion that there wasn't a huge increase in significant alternate diagnoses or admission to the hospital. And basically, it didn't have much effect on the acute care of patients in the ED. Bad things that we found, aneurysm is always the one that people mention, but we actually only found that in 1.2% of the bad things. The biggest thing we actually found was CT evidence of pylo, which you can exclude with a urine usually. But actually, the next biggest thing is diverticulitis, which I always think is kind of interesting that that's probably the number one alternate diagnosis when you think somebody might have a kidney stone, and there's reason to believe that might actually be self-limited. So aneurysm dissection, small. Incidental findings, we studied this as well. In over 5,000 CTs, more than 12% of patients had an incidental finding, and this is something that is not related to their symptoms, but that, according to the radiology report, needs a follow-up test. So it puts you at risk. It is largely not helpful to the patients. Vast majority of these are false positives or incidental findings, and these are often called incidentalomas. There's stuff on this. My favorite acronym about this is VOMIT, victims of modern imaging technology. And that talks about people who get these false positives. They go for a biopsy. It causes complications, lots of expense. But really, a lot of those findings are no better than you would get if you CT people walking down the street, which we know is probably not a good idea for screening. What's the cancer risk? This is controversial, and I could talk about this for another hour or two, but the best estimates are probably about 1 in 1,000. So the routine abdomen pelvis non-contrast CT is estimated to cause a malignancy for every 1,000 CT scans we're doing. And if we're doing probably on the order of 500,000 a year in the ED for kidney stone, you think that is probably on the order of 5,000 malignancies later on. And that is, again, debatable, but something to keep in mind. So this is a big article a few years ago, ultrasonography versus CT for suspected kidney stone. Rebecca Smith-Feinman, my colleague out on the West Coast, also funded by the AHRQ to look at this issue. And a lot of emergency physicians who perform point-of-care ultrasound found that actually it decreased radiation and didn't impact alternate diagnoses. So let's say we do an ultrasound on this guy, the 37-year-old guy that comes in. This patient has hydronephrosis. So what do you do now? I get a renal ultrasound. So we got the renal ultrasound, got hydro. A lot of people would say, well, there's hydro. Now I need to know how big the stone is, so I'm going to get a CT. Some people might say, well, now I'm really sure it's a stone. But a lot of people think that once you have hydro, you need to get a CT to characterize the stone. So then the alternate is you get an ultrasound of a normal kidney without hydro. And then you say, well, what do you do now? You got this normal ultrasound, and people say, well, I get a CT. And you say, why? Well, because it's an alternate diagnosis. I don't know what it is now. And this, there's some logic to that, but I just want to put it in a little bit of perspective here.
I love this example here. What you're saying is that in a lot of common practice, basically no matter what the ultrasound shows, patients are going to get a CT.
I will comment that the New England Journal ultrasound study did reduce radiation, didn't increase adverse outcomes. But one thing that people always tell me, and the urologists as well, is that they would like a CT scan before the patient shows up at their clinic. And that's not unreasonable if they're planning an operative intervention. The key part of that is picking the people that need to see a urologist. And probably more than 80% of stones will pass spontaneously without intervention. The two reasons we get a CT are to watch out for something else that might be bad, and knowing where the stone is, how big it is, and where it's located. So what can help you with this? Very briefly, as I want to give time for questions, we derived and validated the stone score, STONE, sex, timing, origin, nausea, and erythrocytes, which is a mnemonic for basically the risk factors for kidney stone. It performs slightly better than Gestalt, particularly with novice clinicians, and it provides an objective way to gauge your likelihood of stone. Basically, if you had a range of 10 to 13, a high stone score, you're in the 90% range of likelihood for stone. We followed this up with the Stone Plus, which shows the impact of ultrasound on the stone score. And basically, if you really have a very highly likely kidney stone, ultrasound doesn't help that much. It lowers it some if there's no hydro, and it raises it some if there is hydro. But it's most helpful if you start with a 50% pretest probability in the moderate group, and then you have hydro, or low, and you have hydro, especially moderate hydro. So those are the ones that I use the point-of-care ultrasound in more to tell me if the likelihood of stone. Again, briefly, we've done a fair amount of work in what's called reduced radiation dose CT or low dose CT. Kidney stones light up really well. It's opportunity to reduce radiation without missing diagnoses and actually having fewer incidental findings. The radiation variation across facilities in the United States is vast. You could walk into one hospital and get a dose of DLT for kidney stone of 300. You could walk across the street for the same test and get five times the radiation, with other ones falling in between, and an average of about 11 millisieverts. Low-dose CT falls well below the background radiation, while your average CT is nearly twice background radiation. And just to highlight this, this is recommended in algorithms by the AUA, by the ACR, and by ASEP and ACR together, which is to use reduced dose. So if you're going to do a CT, I'd like you to consider this. This is an imaging algorithm that we developed as part of the Stone Plus, which basically says if you really think it's a stone and you feel like it needs to have a CT, then get a low-dose or reduced-dose CT. Alternately, if you know, you're really sure this is a stone, they get better with symptomatic treatment, you know, send them out. They can follow up with their primary care provider, and if they need to follow up with the urologist, they can get a CT at that point. And you can probably eliminate 4 out of 5 CTs. You can get people out of your emergency department faster. You can avoid incidental findings, avoid radiation, avoid cost. If you really don't know what's going on with them, they don't have hydro, and they're at lower risk for stone, then I would recommend a contrast-enhanced CT to look for alternate diagnoses. Take-home is that first-time renal colic, I don't believe there's good evidence that it requires a CT despite the sort of national norm that is taking place now. Just be aware of what you're doing when you get a CT in terms of incidental findings, radiation costs. There is an objective clinical prediction rule with point-of-care ultrasound. And then if you do a CT, consider reduced dose.
All right, thank you so much, Dr. Moore. Next up, we have Dr. Jeff Klein, who is an emergency medicine physician and professor of emergency medicine and physiology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. He's the vice chair of the research division there and is editor-in-chief for academic emergency medicine. He's here to talk to us today about PE and clinical decision rules that surround imaging for PE, as he is an international expert in this field.
All right, let's go through a case to illustrate the downstream effects of, in some cases, overtesting. This case is going to be a borderline case of overtesting. It's a real person, of course. It's someone that I continue to treat in one of my clinics that serves as a follow-up clinic for patients that are diagnosed with blood clots in the emergency departments that I work at here in Indianapolis. This is a 29-year-old lady who was on her honeymoon in Italy and returned with these symptoms. If you talk to her, she had been having these symptoms for a while, but they seemed to get worse after her long-haul flight. There's a couple of key things about her. What the physician thought about her in real time, typing into Cerner: palpitations, chest discomfort, dyspnea, tightness in chest, acute onset. Went to work today. Remember, she got home yesterday from her honeymoon. Felt like she couldn't take a deep breath. You know, some of this are some words that make us a little worried. Blood pressure high before coming to the ED. Everything went black. Maybe it was passing out. She was in Italy, and passing out in Italy is bad news, but she didn't pass out in Italy. She got sort of unconscious like here. And so some of this stuff is somewhat vague. Here's a PE red flag. So somebody's thinking about PE. Got back from honeymoon. I don't know if that's a risk factor, but I think what they mean is long-haul travel. Has been taking oral contraceptives. Look at the vital signs. All right, the first one I want to look at is heart rate. That's always below 100. That's helpful. Sats are good. Sats below 95% anywhere that is not Salt Lake City or Denver are bad news, especially in a young woman that doesn't smoke. A little bit of high blood pressure there, maybe just nervous. Let's get an EKG. First thing I want to look for is pulmonary hypertension. Yep, an S1 Q3 T3 does help. Tachycardia, that increases the probability of pulmonary hypertension, as does T-wave inversion in V1 through V4. I don't see any incomplete right bundle branch block or complete right bundle branch block. And there's no ST elevation in AVR. So, nope, no signs of pulmonary hypertension. This is a normal EKG. And chest X-ray is totally clear, normal, nothing there. No infiltrate, no Hampton pump, no effusions, no basilar atelectasis, nothing. All right, let's think about an algorithm. Here's one. And let's go down, and this is sort of a low pretest prob patient. Can we perk her out? Well, I don't like that term. What I want to do is look up on MDCalc the components of perk. If there's one thing I can say for take home from this, don't memorize decision rules, including the Stone score. Look it up.
I just want to pause here and weigh in and say that I absolutely agree with Dr. Klein. We have fantastic resources to look up all of these decision rules. It's not a bad idea to know what components are in them from a theory standpoint, but I don't think there's any reason to memorize the scoring tools for most of these things. And even if you do have them memorized, I'd encourage you to look them up every time that you use them, just on the off chance that you've forgotten or you're miscalculating.
Perk rule looks like it's positive, so does that make sense to go ahead and do a quant D dimer? I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe not. She's got a lot of things going on. She is on birth control pills, but one of the things I want to know is the details of birth control pills. For example, how long she's been on them. About 95% of ladies that get clots on birth control pills get them in the first 3 months of taking the birth control, because that's when the hypercoagulability really matters. In fact, most of them occur in the first month, so it's a detail, but we don't know it in this patient. Reminder of the perk rule is it requires gestalt low suspicion, meaning that you ask yourself the question, do I think there's less than a 15% probability that the patient will have VTE in the next 45 days? Heart rate always has to be less than 100. It can't be above 100 at triage and then be below 100 afterward. The thing that people forget and the thing that I see in medical malpractice frequently is about the estrogen use, and that was not missed in this particular case. So this is the perk rule. It always predicts a pretest probability less than 2%, and there are multiple new studies out showing its validity. They are even showing it being valid in Europe. And there's a large randomized trial that's completed. It was done by Jonathan Freund out of France, and it's going to be presented at the International Society of Thrombosis Hemostasis in Berlin. And it's a trial of using PERC or using standard of care in Europe. I think we're going to continue to see the PERC rule to be a reasonably valid way or a validated way. Now has a 2B recommendation from American College of Emergency Physicians guidelines to exclude PE. However, this lady flunks it because she's taken birth control pills. We're aware of the growing problem of overtesting, and you know, when we can do nothing in terms of testing, well, we just talked about the PERC rule, and also let's think about some other things, other factors. One thing to think about is that patients in the emergency department don't have the same risk profile as the general population. A lot of what gets taught in medical school is that epidemiological studies are the way you figure out whether somebody has disease when you first meet them. Well, it's not like that in the emergency department. People that are studied longitudinally will have risk factors for clots, for example, that are not risk factors in the emergency department. Reasons for that probably are because we have a sick patient who has decided over a period of a couple of hours, days, or weeks that he or she is sick, and they need to come to the emergency department. So first the human, the patient, and or family screens the patient and brings them in. The second thing is in any research study of PE or DVT, they're twice selected, first by the patient and then by the physician. So that's a lot different than longitudinal studies. So the point of this is things like obesity, atrial fibrillation, and smoking increase the probability that you're going to have pulmonary embolism in the general population. But in the emergency department, they predict alternative diagnoses that are more likely. Same thing goes for renal failure. So here's some doubts and certainties about what increases the risk in the emergency department is not so certain in the emergency department. Surgery is a powerful one. Prior VTE, estrogen use, actually non-O blood type, but that's not one that most docs routinely ask. Extremity mobility, postpartum status. Postpartum is a powerful predictor, just like surgery in active cancer, but not inactive cancer. Travel is less certain. Smoking is not a risk factor. Neither is obesity. Family history is difficult to document in the emergency department. It's been shown to be a risk factor in ambulatory settings in Europe, but not in the United States. In fact, it's never been demonstrated. Pregnancy, well, of course, that increases risk of DVT-PE. Well, it doesn't in symptomatic emergency department patients selected for testing for PE, probably does in the general population. You got to really be careful when you watch the pregnancy literature because there's two issues. One is DVT without PE, and the second is they tend to intermingle postpartum patients with pregnant patients. When you dissect that carefully, pregnancy is not as big a risk factor for PE as all these lecturers will tell you. And here's some other ones that are less certain, like heart failure, for example, which patients with heart failure in the ED are likely to have what when they come in with PE symptoms? And in PE, it's heart failure. Here's some data about immobility specifically, just to look at the different types, qualitative types. General immobility is a risk factor, as is limb, but travel doesn't have a relative ratio, relative risk ratio or a risk ratio much above unity. And the others do as well. So one thing about immobility is that certainly a long-haul flight is worse than not having a long-haul flight. But if you compare that patient to other patients in the emergency department, they're generally healthier, as was this patient. In fact, when I met this patient, because she was followed up in my clinic, I walked into the room, and she's a cheerleader for the Colts. And I don't see a lot of folks like that in my emergency department. Here's a comparison of risks. Sudden onset predicts nothing. Pleuritic chest pain, estrogen, and unexplained dyspnea all have significant risk ratios in the emergency department. But like you can see, substernal chest pain points away. Inactive cancer doesn't predict anything more than what age would predict. Inactive cancer means not under the care of an oncologist, no palliative therapy, no known metastases. Obesity crosses unity but tends to move up toward slightly a risk, and smoking decreases the risk. Why? Trash your airways, the problem's more likely to be airways. So how can we affect change in overtesting? It's knowledge creation. Create rules. We need more than just the PERC rule for specific populations, including issues of how to adjust the D-dimer for multiple populations, not just age. Translate into practice, implement an individual behavior change, which is influenced a lot by what's happened to you in the past and maybe even on the same shift. Here's some social media which says, don't start. And this is a mantra that I have. I can't prove it, but I say if a patient has no chest pain, no dyspnea now or in the past medical history, normal vital signs at all time, no leg swelling equals no PE workup. And I think this goes for syncope as well. Syncope is more controversial, but I still believe that's true. I think patients that are PERC negative that passed out don't need a workup and the data support it. Let's go back to our cheerleader. So she got a D-dimer in the department, and holy crap, that's high. I think that needs a CT scan. She gets a CT scan, and it looks like this, kind of a weird-looking scan, and I'm going to tell you why it's weird-looking. She's got this sort of grayed out looking pulmonary arteries, and this is me wanting to find out what her Hounsfield units are in the pulmonary arteries. Hounsfield units 360. Well, that's good. There's plenty of Hounsfield unit there to be able to distinguish with clot. As long as it's over 200, it's a pretty good scan. If you got a high pretest prob, you order a CT scan, comes back negative. You need to ask your radiologist what the quality of the scan was. The most common reason for degraded quality of scan is low pacification. Second most common reason is obesity, which just degrades images, and the third is tachypnea. But this is a different patient I'm talking about here. This is general education. High pretest prob, negative CT. It's our job as ER docs to ask if the CT scan was good quality. If it's good quality, PE is ruled out. Well, this is a good quality scan, but it is a little weird looking. But this is what you get. Somewhat limited examination secondary to timing of contrast pulse. Well, it's true, she had such jacked up cardiac output, she pushed the contrast through her pulmonary arteries and it was all in the left ventricle when they took the images. And they just kind of waffle and say nothing large or central and no acute cardiopulmonary abnormality.
So you're saying this is one of the few times where being healthy actually hurt her.
So my colleague said, I'm not sure what to do. You're going to go see Klein. That's the Klein Outpatient Treatment Program there. They call it CLOT, K-L-O-T. That wasn't my idea, but somebody else called it that, and it stuck. I think some of my patients believe that's how it's spelled, so it's working out fine. She comes in, and I talked to her extensively and said, no, I don't think you need anticoag. I think your scan's negative. She left and then saw another doctor. He restarted her, referred her to a hematologist that did what hematologists do, and that's a bunch of tests. Found that she had this 4-5 gain of function mutation in PI1. That thing is probably a slight increased risk for PEDVT, but one thing about it is it causes a high D-dimer. A little hard to figure out how plasminogen activator inhibitor causes a high D-dimer. you would think if anything, it would inhibit lysis and reduce it, but it doesn't. So she tried for about a year and a half. She got married and she was trying to get pregnant, went on low molecular weight heparin off and on, saw a bunch of doctors. Since then, this lady who was reasonably appropriately worked up, I gave kind of a borderline case. She flunked PERC. I think it's perfectly reasonable within reasonable and prudent care to have actually done the D-dimer and CT this lady. But she since then has had seven negative CT scans. More than 10 D-dimers are all elevated, probably because of that unusual sequence variation in her PI-1 antigen gene. She's been on and off every oral anticoagulant known. People keep putting her on and taking her off. Still not pregnant, and I can tell you has had major psychological stress as a result of this. I promise you this woman never had clots. She just had an unusual genetic test. She had anxiety and a lot of issues that probably led to the diagnosis or led to the ultimate workup. My point of this is just as something to remember. This lady was reasonably well thought about and worked up, but imagine if, just for example, she wasn't on birth control pills and she got all of this for nothing. We have more patients like this than we know, and it's not until you follow up hundreds and hundreds of patients that you really begin to see not just risk of cancer that Chris was talking about, the wasted testing, the stress on the kidneys, but the psychological effect. I think out of respect for her, I don't want to talk about it more. I don't think there's no HIPAA here or anything, but it messed her up and it's messed her marriage up. And, you know, I think a lot of it is because of that fault and fear of clots that's out there. So the issues raised are unintended consequences of testing. Population risks may not equate to emergency care risks. Diagnostic testing often falls into the gray zone. CT scans are very often inconclusive, more than 10%. Not less than 1%, more than 10% have ambiguous wording from the radiologist. And then thrombophilia testing, like diagnostic testing, can have unintended consequences.
Thanks, Dr. Klein. That was fantastic. I did actually have a question for Dr. Moore regarding the low-dose CT. If that's something that we wanted to start doing at our own institution, who do we talk to and how do we go about implementing it?
Thanks for asking. You can talk to us. We have the DOSE project, Dose Optimization and Stone Evaluation. We have a website. We can provide individualized consultation. Basically, because kidney stones are high contrast, you can reduce the dose without sacrificing sensitivity or specificity much. A meta-analysis a few years back showed sensitivity about 97%, specificity around that as well. So you're really not missing much. We've actually found incidental findings are lower. You still can diagnose the bad other things, appendicitis, AAA, with a reduced dose. Problem is, most of the kidney stone CTs are actually just contrast-enhanced CTs without the contrast. In other words, they use the same settings that you would to look in detail for diverticulitis or appendicitis. There's ways to basically decrease that dose. Now, why don't radiologists want to do that? Often because they're thinking we're just ordering a non-contrast CT because we don't want to deal with contrast and we're still worried about all these other potential problems. So I think the key is to be ordering in the right patients, which requires communication. We set it up in our Epic system to order that. We've put our stone score into Epic. We're working on revamping that with ACR Select. And basically, if you have a high likelihood of kidney stone, even if it's gestalt, or if you're doing repeat scans, the emergency physician really has the option to request a reduced radiation dose, and the radiologist should respect that. But the other side of that is for the emergency physicians not to abuse the flank pain protocol CT as a quick way to get a non-contrast scan looking for other things. So I won't say anything more about it, but it's definitely possible, and we've had good experience with it, and please contact me if you're interested.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Moore and Klein, for being here with us today. And we appreciate all you listeners for tuning in once again. I've been your host, Dr. Jason Woods. You can find me at jwoodsmd on Twitter or through Gmail at jasonwoodsmd@gmail.com. You can find the rest of our ASEP Equal series through the Alium website at www.alium.com or through our podcast feed. Search Alium in the iTunes podcast app.